Very good. So the last session is the big one. Who are you? Or are you there at all? Here we're going to go to the deepest question of life. This person inside of you who came here today, who goes from life to life, what is it really all about? Who are you? Or are you? What is the teaching of the Buddha about anatta, the key to enlightenment? It's a strange thing when we talk about who we are, because the more we have a solid sense of self, the bigger ego we have, the more problems we cause in life. You've ever seen people with big egos? There's one sitting next to you right now. A person with a big ego creates lots of problems in this world. And it's those big egos which cause, like, pride. Are you a proud person? Too proud to admit you make mistakes sometimes? So proud? How many people here have never made a mistake? Put your hand up if you've never made a mistake. If you do put your hand up, that's another mistake you made. But proud people never think they make a mistake. Or they try and hide it under the carpet and pretend that nobody noticed. This is a Muslim story. This is about the, I don't know if you've ever heard about this character called Nasruddin. He was a Sufi. He got some wonderful stories about him. And one day he was like a guru, and he had disciples, just like monks have disciples. And one day after a meditation retreat or something like that, or a seminar, as a prize, he let his disciples follow him to a fair. And as he was going to the fair, they saw one of these booths where you could fire an arrow at the target, and if you hit the target, you got a prize. So here was this Sufi cleric, like a monk. He went there and said, "I'll have a go." And his disciples said, "Have you ever fired a bow and arrow before in your life?" He said, "No." He said, "Don't do it. You're a religious leader. You make a fool of yourself and everybody will laugh at us." But he said, "I don't care." And so he brought three arrows. And he lined up the first shot. And this one, he lined it up and shot it. And it went about only halfway to the target before it fell in the earth. He was hopeless. And the disciples started to get embarrassed as the people saw this religious leader start to make a fool of himself. But Nasruddin, he just turned around and said, "That was a shot of a hasty man." And he put his second arrow in the bow, and this time it took more time. He lined up the target and he shot. This time it made the distance, but it went about a mile to the left, almost hit a spectator. And the people started to giggle. But Nasruddin said, "Now that was a shot of a proud man." And the disciples said, "Leave it now, you're just making an idiot, a fool of yourself." But he said, "No, I've got one arrow left." And this one he lined up and he shot the arrow and it went right in the middle of the bullseye. And he got his prize, it silenced all his critics. And the disciples said, "If the first shot was a shot of a hasty man, and the third shot was a shot of a proud man, what was the third shot?" And Nasruddin said, "Oh, that was me." That was a trouble sometimes when people are proud. There was another story from the Thai tradition. Very similar, but this was not a monk. This was one of these very intelligent and clever men who was so smart that he was invited to join the court of one of the Thai kings. But he was so intelligent and he was sometimes so egotistical that other members of the court were so jealous of him. And he was one of the king's favorites, and so all the other people in the court, they met together one day and said, "This guy, he really sort of gets up our noses. We hate this guy, but he's so popular with the king. How can we show him up towards the king?" And they got this plan together. This guy is so proud, he thinks he knows everything. Tomorrow morning, this is our plan. We'll praise him in front of His Majesty. We'll say, this man, he's so smart, he knows everything. And see what he says. And he'll probably say yes. And he said, he probably even knows what we're thinking. And he might say yes. And if he does, even if he does know what we're thinking, we'll lie, because who can prove what you're thinking? And that was their plan. And the following morning, when the court assembled, when the king sat on his throne, one of the ministers started praising this intelligent man. He's so bright, he knows everything. And this man said, yes, I know everything. He probably even knows what we're thinking. Yes, I know what you're all thinking. Okay, what is it? What are we thinking? He'd fallen into the trap. If they said he was thinking about food, he would say no. Whatever they said, they decided they would say no. What are we all thinking? They asked him. And without hesitation, this courtier said, all of you, you're all thinking kind thoughts towards His Majesty. And they all said, yes, we are. You're so clever. Because if they said the opposite, they'd be in big trouble. So sometimes, proud people, they really upset us. And why are people proud? It's because they attach to their idea of who they are. Sometimes, you know, it's very easy if you're a teacher to attach to the idea that you're a teacher. And sometimes you get it wrong. You make a mistake. And if you do make a mistake, it's much better to admit it. I make mistakes sometimes. I remember this one story of one of my monks who made a mistake a long time ago. Because in our monastery, all of the things which are in our monastery all come as donations from people such as you who give a ringgit here, a ringgit there. And especially in the early years of my monastery when we were quite poor, and when I was the abbot, I was very insistent that my monks don't waste anything. I kept on reminding them that, you know, our donors, they weren't rich people. Some of them were ordinary people. Sometimes they were out of work, but they would still bring food to feed the monks. So imagine what it was like when one day I was walking in the grounds of my monastery and I saw a hammer which had been left out in the rain and was getting rusty. It must have been out there for over a week. And some careless monk had left it out there. So I called a meeting of the monks. Now you may think I'm a soft monk, and I'm very kind and gentle, but sometimes you've got to be fierce. So I was fierce. I gave this sermon about looking after the gifts which people give you. You never brought that hammer. It's the gift of kind people. If they saw this hammer left out there getting rusty, what would they think? You're spoiling their faith. They think, what's the purpose of giving these things to monks who are so careless they don't even bother to put the tools away after they use them? This is not on. The Buddha would not approve. It's bad karma. You should not do these things. Don't do it again. And who was it? And all the monks, you know, sometimes when you give a talk, people are lounging this way and lounging that way like you are. But all the monks were sitting absolutely straight. I really hammered them this time. I really gave them a really fire and brimstone sermon. Which one was it? Not one of them confessed. And that, you know, that was the most disappointing of all. I thought that, well, I must admit, I was a bit tough. I did actually really, you know, go a bit over the top with my fierceness. I can be fierce at times. But maybe it was because they were all scared. I was disappointed because at least if you'd done something wrong, you should admit it. But no one would. So I went out of that hall after that talk, really disappointed in the monks under my training. Why can't they just say sorry? I'd have forgiven them. And as I walked out, I understood had an insight, understood why no one would confess. Because I remembered who had left that hammer out. It was me. And I'd forgotten all about it until after I'd scolded all the monks. One of the most embarrassing times of my life as a monk. I don't know why it is. You tell everybody off first and then you remember. If I'd have remembered first, it'd be much less embarrassing. So what did I do? I had to go back in there and say, sit down, everybody. I found out who left the hammer out. And as my penance, I tell that story often. And I wrote it in my book as well. But the point of that story is that we all make mistakes. And it's the ego stops us admitting that we are at fault. And that ego stops us asking for forgiveness. That ego stops us solving the problem with a simple, I'm sorry. When you say sorry, it's so easy to forgive and move on. If any of you have misbehaved, if you men have had a mistress and broken that third precept, tell your wife. Say sorry. Not disaster. The disaster's already happened when you first had the mistress. This is solving the disaster. And ask her forgiveness. It's a wonderful thing if you ask with real sincerity, and especially if your wife has been here all day, and if she can't forgive, then I don't know what you've been listening to all day. Now is your best chance after you've been listening to Ajahn Brahm for 2.5 days. And if someone says that, please forgive them if it's really sincere, as long as they're acknowledging, they're forgiving, and they're learning not to do that again, then that's fine. You know, there was an old Somerset Maugham story I remember reading as a young man. It was about these two planters. I think they could have been in Malaysia. It could have been one of those Somerset Maugham stories from Malaysia. You know, some rubber plantation or coconut oil plantation. And there was a man there with his wife, and his best friend was helping him in his plantation. And one day the wife had a tragic accident. And one of the workers came back to tell the husband, I'm sorry, your wife has died. Oh no, sorry, no, it's the other way around, sorry. The husband, the wife, and the best friend. The best friend had the accident. And as soon as the worker came back and told the man, the owner of the plantation, your best friend has suddenly died, his wife fainted. It's a dead giveaway. His wife had been having an affair with his best friend. So she had to confess afterwards. And he wanted to divorce her. But it was an English man who ran the next plantation. There were neighbors. He came to him and said, don't do that. Forgive her. He said, I had a wife. She had an affair with someone else. I divorced her. I never gave her a second chance, even though she pleaded for one. For the rest of my years, I've been so lonely. Forgive. Because if you can forgive, and the other person can live up to that forgiveness, there is a healing. So, don't be so proud, especially you women, thinking, he's preferred someone other than me. A lot of time it's a pride which does things, the ego. How can I tell my friends? How can I live this up? Don't worry what your friends think. It's your feelings and your future are more important. Forgiveness is much easier when you have a small ego. People with big egos find it difficult to forgive. So the more we understand the teaching of anatta, the easier it is to forgive others and forgive ourselves and have a much happier life. The ego of ourselves worries what other people think of us. I don't know how many of you are concerned about your reputation. Sometimes you've actually been so concerned, instead of asking a question in public, you've written it in private. And say, please, Ajahn Brahm, don't tell anybody. Now I'm going to read them out. No, I won't. I wouldn't do that to you. But what's wrong with actually saying what happened? In the end, you know, that people, this is an old story, that when you're in your 20s as a young person, you are very, very concerned what other people think of you. That's why young girls have to dress up and they have to keep the fashion. And they have a lot of peer pressure, you know, to be fashionable. Young men have to have what's called in the West street cred. They have to know all the modern words. They have to have an iPod in their ear all the time, even though their mother is talking. They have to, you know, this is young men, what they're supposed to do. And I remember as a young man myself going to dances and parties. This was before I was a monk. And sometimes you see a nice girl there and you want to go and talk to her, but you get nervous. And why was I nervous? Because I was scared what she would think of me. And so you start practicing what you're going to say. And you go up to her and you say the wrong thing. The words would get all jumbled up. Now, you've had that, remember, when, you know, you girls, when a young man came to see you, sometimes you've got to help them along if you like them. And it's the same with the girls as well. And it was only much, much later, you know, that I realized that's not the way to do things. When you're very young, you're so concerned what other people think of you. When you get to your 40s, as the old saying goes, you get what we call self-confidence. Most people in general. When you're in your 40s, you don't care what other people think of you. You just go and do it anyway. You're yourself. You can ask silly questions. Who cares what other people think of me? You get self-confidence. But the best time comes in your 60s. In your 20s, you're concerned what other people think of you. In your 40s, you don't give a care what other people think of you. In your 60s, you finally discover that people weren't thinking about you anyway. Everybody was thinking about themselves. When I used to go up to those girls and wondering, what's she thinking about me? She was always thinking, what's he thinking about me? Everybody was concerned about themselves. So you don't have to worry what people think of you. You just be yourself, whatever that happens to be. When you're not concerned what other people think of you, you don't have to defend your ego and yourself. And who are you anyway? Sometimes people look at me, I'm supposed to be an abbot. What's an abbot supposed to be anyway? That's why I play around sometimes. You know, change the roles. Sometimes, you know, I'm a comedian sometimes. And when I was in Melbourne giving a talk, after the talk, this young man came up to me afterwards and offered me a job. That's right, as a stand-up comic. He was a professional comedian who went on the television in Australia. I don't watch the TV, so I couldn't recognize him, but apparently he was quite well known. And he was saying, Ajahn Brahm, your timing is perfect. And your material, where do you get it from? And you've got, you know, like every comedian has to have their peculiarity. You're a monk in your robes. You can make a fortune on TV. I'll get you the opening. You can be a stand-up comic. I was given a job opportunity. But in the end, I decided my day job was much better, so I decided to stick with being a monk. But the point is that sometimes, if you're a speaker, sometimes you've got to be the comedian. Sometimes you've got to be the counselor. Sometimes you've got to be the supervisor and tell your monks off. Sometimes you're the builder. Sometimes you have to be the diplomat, you know, with the queen. You know the difference between a diplomat and a gentleman? I don't know if I should tell this joke. Tell it? Yeah. I promise I won't get into trouble? No. Okay. Okay. Here we go. I'm leaving this evening, so it doesn't really matter. It's an old joke. Difference between a diplomat and a gentleman. If a diplomat says yes, they mean maybe. When they say maybe, they mean no. If they say no, they're not a diplomat. You know that, don't you? Because you know, you upset people. So say maybe. So when people say, when are you going to, you know, say Penang? I say, well, you know, maybe. I'm a diplomat. So that's the difference. A diplomat, when they say yes, they mean maybe. When they say maybe, they mean no. When they say no, they're not a diplomat. A lady, this is the old type of ladies, if they say no, they mean maybe. If they say maybe, they mean yes. If they say yes, they're not a lady. I'll get into trouble for that for sure. How did I get into that one? Anyway, yeah. So who are you anyway? So the point is, sometimes I'm a diplomat, sometimes I'm a worker. The thing is that when you haven't got a fixed idea of who you are, you can be anyone you want to be. Sometimes I'm an idiot and say stupid things. Sometimes I say the wisest thing. You know, sometimes when I give a talk, because I don't even plan the talk, sometimes I'm saying something, I think, wow, that makes a lot of sense. I get inspired by what I say. Where did that one come from? And other times, I say a dumb thing and I get into trouble for it afterwards. But which one is the right Ajahn Brahm? None of them are. It's just you're always changing to suit the circumstances. It's like Ajahn Chah when he first went to the West. We asked him, what's it like in the West? And he said, oh, when you go to England, he said, you know, or the West, you have to smile. He said, if I went to Japan, he said, I'd have to be severe. He said, wherever you go, you have to fit into the cultures of that place. And that's why you can actually change, you can adapt to the different people. Now that's the sign of like a great monk, who you can never pin him down, what he is or who he is, because he was no one at all. He was empty. When you understand the teaching of non-self, when you know there's no one in here, it means there's no fixed entity, which means you're always able to change. I don't know, have you ever done well at school? Were you intelligent? If you thought you were no good, say at maths, you would be no good. And as a school teacher, I was very careful never to think that someone was bad at anything. That was actually creating a self, saying, I can't do this. And I experimented once with one child in my class who came bottom in mathematics the year before. And I was teaching him mathematics that year. Knowing he'd came bottom, I wanted to do an experiment. Was that because he was a self which just couldn't do maths? Or was it something else? So for one whole year, I gave him special attention. During the class, when I was setting the test, the problems, I would go and stand next to him and ask if he understood it, and maybe help him to explain it a bit further. At the end of the class, I'd ask him, was that okay? Can you understand that? I gave him special attention and encouragement. At the end of the year, he came top in math. It surprised me and everybody else, and surprised him the most. I took him from being bottom to the top in one year, just through extra attention. It was unfair on all the other children, I admit that. But nevertheless, it proves an important thing to me. There's no one who can't do maths. There's no one who can't do sport. There's no one who can't do meditation. There's no one who can't do enlightenment. All you need is extra special attention. Some of you need heaps of extra special attention. But it's a wonderful thing. What non-self means is you're malleable, you're plastic, you can do whatever you want, if you have the confidence to do it. So the teaching of non-self is an opportunity. You are not stuck in your past. Doesn't matter what you failed at, it's only failing now. You can still do whatever you like for the future. You are changeable, you're malleable. If you had a self which was solid and imperfect, there's nothing you can do about it. You're stuck with it, but you're not. It's always changing. And as you understand this more and more, it means you don't need to be stuck in the past. Doesn't matter who you think you are, there's no such thing as being intelligent or not intelligent. I can do it, I can't do it. Everything is open when there's no fixed I. Now, as you understand this more and more, it leaves every opportunity open for you. There's no door which is closed to you when you have a malleable self. And that's why when you see highly attained monks or nuns, it's amazing just how they can change and do different things, simply because they've got a plastic self. Malleable, changeable, just like rubber which can be bent and changed into whatever they want it to be. And I saw Ajahn Chah doing that so often. He could be the very, very kind counselor. Next moment he could be the fierce master. Next moment he could be laying bricks with everybody else and sharing a joke. It's great to see how people can change the less they are there. And always happy because whatever other body said about them, that's not really me. How can you take any criticism? They say, who was stupid? It wasn't me. It wasn't me who left that hammer out there. Just my 5 khandhas, that's all. Just my body and mind. Blame them, don't blame me. Whenever you understand the teaching of non-self, it gives you a lot of freedom. But the problem is, how can we actually penetrate that teaching and see it for what it truly is? Because we've got so much heavy conditioning, this sense of I, we've even given ourselves a name. Isn't it great to be able to change? I'm thinking of actually changing my name. So when I go to Singapore Airport and go in the toilet, Ajahn Bum, I say, no, it's not Ajahn Bum, it's somebody else. Even changing my face, because for many years I suffered from hay fever. And nothing worked. It's actually cured it now. I went on a retreat and it's just almost gone. It's amazing what meditation can do. But for many years I was always struggling with hay fever. You'd be meditating, you'd be so close to enlightenment, and then you'd blow it, literally. And so I was reading in the newspapers that if you've got a bad heart, you could have a heart transplant. If you've got a bad liver, you can have a liver transplant. So I wanted a nose transplant. And I thought, because I come to Malaysia and Singapore very often, why not have a Chinese nose? Wouldn't that be a wonderful symbol of multiculturalism? Or even better, because I was in Australia, maybe a black nose, an Aboriginal nose. So which one would really be me? Now the point is, actually, to understand just know what non-self truly is. There's two parts of the self. This is a serious part of the talk now. There's two parts to this thing you call you. The first part is what I call the doer, the will. Who decided to come here? Who decided to write that words on a piece of paper? Who decided to turn their head? Who decided to look in their bag? Who decided to get off the chair and go to the toilet? What is this thing we call the doer or will? Because that's important for you. Because sometimes you want to do something and it never goes right. A lot of times we practice meditation, we go to school, we go to courses to make sure our will gets more effective, so we can achieve more things in life. The first part of the self is the one in charge, the will. The second part of the self is what we call the one who knows, the knower consciousness. The first is the active part of the mind. The second is the passive part, that which knows. Now, when you investigate deeper. What is this will, this choice, this doer? It gets fascinating. Many years ago, I gave the simile of the driverless bus. This is an original Ajahn Brahm simile. You won't hear this anywhere else. If any other monk repeats this, you should demand royalties for Ajahn Brahm. The driverless bus goes like this. Life is like a bus journey. Sometimes on your journey through life, You have a wonderful time. You have a wonderful, lovely family experience, good health, happiness, prosperity. And you want it to last as long as possible. But sometimes it doesn't last as long as it should. Things go wrong. This is like going on the bus journey and you go through some beautiful scenic countryside of rolling hills and waterfalls and flower-laden glens, and it doesn't last as long as you expect. So you tell the bus driver, slow down, stop, I want to enjoy the beauty which is surrounding me. And too often, when you're having a good time, the bus driver speeds up. The good times don't seem to last as long as they should. Because the will, the driver, does not know its job. And other times your bus journey passes through some very unscenic, ugly, distressing territory. It goes through what we call the toxic waste dumps of life. And you all know what I mean by that. Sometimes you're having a lot of pain, difficulty, distressing experiences in life. Like the bus driver going through the unscenic, ugly places. So you tell the bus driver, speed up, hurry out of here, as you try and tell your will, please find a way to solve this problem, get out of this pain as soon as possible. But very often when life is difficult, the bus driver slows down, even stops. And the terrible suffering times last longer than they should. So what do you do when you have suffering? You come to Ajahn Brahm for counseling or somebody else to see if you can find a way of getting out quicker. Now the trouble is that you have to find that will, that bus driver, before you can teach them how to drive the bus better, how to slow down in the happy times and rush out of the painful times. So you have to find out who's actually in control. Where are they? And to be able to teach the controller, that which drives your life, and teach them a lesson. Teach them how to drive and experience more happiness and less pain. Where do you think that your will resides? It resides deep inside of you. And when we do meditation, we always go inside. Deep, deep, deep into the moment, into the body, into the silence, into the mind. That's why we call this insight meditation. We're seeing inside. You know what the opposite of insight meditation is? Excite meditation. So this is not about excite, which is exciting. This is insight, being still. So you do insight. You see deep within yourself until you come to the bus driver's seat. You see the source of your will. Who is in charge of you? And that is where, in deep meditation, you get one of those powerful deep insights which changes your whole life. It's not what you expect. Deep in your meditation, you find the bus driver's seat is empty. No one is there. Have you ever heard of emptiness? Sunyata. The bus driver's seat is empty. When you see that, you know what you do next? You go back to your seat on the bus, you sit down, and you stop complaining, because there's no one to complain to anymore. You shut up and enjoy the ride. When you realize you're not in control, it's like flying on Singapore Airlines, like I'm doing this evening, from Kuala Lumpur back to Perth. I've got many things to do. I'm in a hurry. So sometimes I've thought of going up to the cabin and telling the pilot, can you hurry up, please? Sometimes I thought of, you know, can I see Borodpudor from the air? Because we pass over it on the aircraft to Perth. Can you make a little detour, please, for me? Now, of course, no pilot would do that. In fact, when you're in an aircraft, you're completely out of control. Oh, so what do you do when you're in an aircraft? You sit in your seat and just enjoy the in-flight service. The in-flight, not the in-flight service. So that's what you do in life. You sit down and enjoy the in-flight service. Now what we mean here is, when you see non-self, you stop complaining. Welcome to life. People live, people die. Husbands are husbands, wives are wives, monks are monks. Why do we complain so much? There's an old statue in a monastery in the south of Thailand. And Ajahn Chah liked it so much, we have a picture of him in England imitating the statue. The statue is this monk, freshly enlightened, with his arms up in the air. And the caption is, joy at last, to know there's no happiness in the world. Joy at last, to know there's no happiness in the world. What a wonderful, deep saying that is. We always think that if we can control a little bit more, if we can get this self in line so it's wise, then we won't need to suffer anymore. But this was a realization. Joy at last. This can't be done. So you just sit down in your seat and stop complaining. The end of craving. I really love the idea of will in science. And there was these wonderful experiments which I saw in my youth and which I read about in the books even today, in the journals of psychology. Who is it in charge? One of the most meaningful experiments which I saw was as a student. I'd already mentioned that I was an active member of the Psychic Research Society of Cambridge University. Every year we used to get these weirdos coming to give lectures. Every year we'd have this witch come along. He was a real witch. I still remember his name, Trevor Ravenscroft. What a great name for a witch. And he would come up there, and I remember his introduction. We were always a bit concerned about, you know, witches. What are they going to do to us? But a student, you go to anything. And he'd say, yes, I'm a witch. And he said there are two types of witches, black witches and white witches. The black witches are the dangerous ones. Be very careful, they are evil. The white witches are the good ones. Having said that, he said, now I'm a white witch. And we said, that's good luck. And then he smiled and said, but even black witches lie and say they're white witches. I remember actually the story of this English witch just after the Second World War. And I remember reading her biography. She was a very, very nice lady and very kind. She was obviously like a white witch. But she went to the United States to give some lectures. You know, she came out, she was a witch, and had the long red hair and everything else. And so she got invited on a lecture tour to the United States. But in those days, before aircraft, she had to go on the boat, on the cruise, not the the passenger ship, you know, from Southampton to New York. And as luck would have it, as fate would have it, she had to share a cabin with this evangelical Christian. Now, this evangelical Christian insisted of doing this religious service every night, and doing this praying and singing hymns. Now when you're sharing a cabin, it's only confined quarters, you've got to be sensitive to each other. So she kept on saying, look, you're making too much noise, can you tone it down please? And the Christian said, no, this is my service, I've got to do this, can you please calm it down? And she just wouldn't. So the witch got out her knives and her instruments and she did a witch service. And she had the cabin to herself for the rest of the voyage. But anyway, it's not about witches, because every year in this psychic research society, we'd always have a hypnotist come. And this hypnotist, because we were students, everyone would volunteer. I volunteered once, but I'm not a hypnotic subject. You can tell very quickly, you know, who can be hypnotized and who can't. And there was always one student who was a great subject. So they'd hypnotize this poor guy or poor girl. And once in hypnosis, they make them do absolutely stupid things. It was so entertaining, so much fun. We were really mean and nasty in those days. But one of the things which the hypnotist did on this first occasion, he told this young student doing stupid, embarrassing things, he said, after I take you out of hypnosis, I'm going to touch my left earlobe. And when I do, you will stand up and sing the British National Anthem in full voice. When I touch my left ear, you will sing the British National Anthem. But when you come out of hypnosis, you won't remember that. But I will touch my left ear, you will sing that. We always wondered whether that would work. So after finishing making him do embarrassing things, he took him out of hypnosis and sent him to sit down. And for the next about 15 or 20 minutes, he was a great entertainer. Because every now and again he'd moved his finger to his ear and then to scratch his nose. He'd have us on the edge of the seats. But finally, he touched his ear. And this little student stood up and started shouting, God save the Queen! And he sang the whole national anthem. And we were just almost weeing ourselves with laughter. But what happened next? When he finished, the hypnotist asked him, why did you do that? And that young man gave a cogent reason. It was quite clear to everybody in that audience that that young man thought he'd freely decided to sing the national anthem out of a moment of patriotism, when we all know he had no choice at all. He was completely brainwashed. What you think is free will, maybe it's not free will after all. When you go to the shops to buy some cornflakes, when you buy a car. Wow, there's a lot of questions now. I really stir people up. Yes, at the back. If you collect good karma, can you drive that bus? No, you can't drive that bus. Even with people with good karma, things go wrong sometimes. It's one of those questions. Sometimes say, this person, they were so generous, they were so good, they kept the five precepts, and had all these things happen to them. Why? Have you seen that in the world? Say, why does that happen? The Buddha actually gave this simile of the stick. If you toss up a stick, you see this pen here, it's got the ink and the sort of the other end. If I throw up this stick, which end would it drop on? You don't really know. The heavier end, if this was very heavy and weighted, it's more likely it will fall on that end. But it doesn't always fall on that end. Sometimes the stick falls on the light end. By making good karma, you're increasing the chances of happiness. But sometimes, even with good karma, the stick lands on the other end. He said, this is a simile of the stick, which makes you very scared of samsara. Even with good karma, you can't control the world, you just influence it. You make it less likely the bus goes through bad territory. But now and again it will still go through bad territory. Because the stick has two ends. Karma has two ends too. The good end, the bad end. So in the end, the only thing to do is to transcend that karma. That's why enlightenment is the end of all karma. There the karma becomes sometimes what we call a hosi karma. Karma from the past which will never reach you again. You become free of karma. Does that answer the question? It's a deep question. But sometimes answer the question. Yes, you had a question. Who was the next one? Go on, yeah?
Meditation was the difference between concentration and insight.
What's the difference between concentration and insight? The answer is that one day, Mrs. Samatha and Mr. Vipassana, who were devoted couple, they were married a long time ago by the Buddha, Mrs. Samatha and Mr. Vipassana decided to go for a walk up on top of a hill. Mrs. Samatha went up there because it was so peaceful and quiet on top of the mountain. But Mr. Vipassana, he went up there for the view. So there was Mrs. Samatha and Mr. Vipassana walking up the mountain together. One going up there for the peace and quiet, the other one going up there for the view. When they got to the top of the mountain, Mrs. Samatha was so happy, was so peaceful up there. But you know, she also noticed the view. And Mr. Vipassana, he saw this gorgeous view, but he also appreciated the peace and quiet up there. You know why? Because on top of the mountain, there is both peace and a view. So it doesn't matter whether you walk up that mountain for the view and think you're doing Vipassana meditation, or if you're walking up that mountain for the peace and quiet, thinking you're doing Samatha meditation. When you get to that top of the mountain, you experience both, because they coexist in the deep stillness of the mind, in the insight which comes from such stillness. That's the answer to your question. They are the same. My teacher said that again and again. When he'd say, you can see my hand here, you can just see the front of my hand, but I guarantee you the back is right behind. Now you see the back of my hand, but the front is right behind. I cannot split the front and the back of my hand. They always go together. Sometimes you only see one part. Now that you just see Samatha. But I tell you that Vipassana is right behind. Sometimes you just see Vipassana. But I tell you, Samatha is right behind. The sign of deep concentration or stillness is the insight which you gain from it. The sign of insight is the calm which it produces. If you have some insight and you're not peaceful afterwards, that is not insight. It's just an idea. So insight is known by the calm it produces, and calm is known by the insight it generates. They always go together. Mrs. Samatha, Mr. Vipassana, married by the Buddha a long time ago. So the next question, I'm going to do some. What is the next step after seeing our body disappear in our meditation? The next step is seeing your will disappear. That's called second jhana. And that is weird. In the second jhana, you cannot move. You know why you can't move, why it's so still? I don't usually use the word concentration anymore. That gives the wrong impression. I call states of still awareness. The deeper the stillness, the deeper the meditation. So that's why the jhanas are deep still awareness. In the second jhana, you are so still. The reason why you're still is because there's nothing left to move you. The potential to do is gone. Now this is much different than just saying, I'm not going to do anything. This is where you can't do anything. You're that still, the will or the potential to do has completely vanished. Earlier today, I told a simile of watching the ocean, seeing things rise and fall, and then suddenly the ocean completely vanishes. This is what I meant. The will, which was always there, has suddenly gone. Only then do you understand what the will is. Once upon a time, there was a little tadpole swimming in the lake. He was a philosophical tadpole. And he would listen to all the frogs talk about this amazing state called dry land. But he could never understand dry land. When he asked the frogs, is dry land wet? He said, no, of course it's not wet. Any fishes there? No, there's no fishes in dry land. It was completely beyond his experience. He couldn't understand it at all. Even when he asked what the opposite was, water. Even though he swam in it every day, the tadpole just could not understand what water was. How could you when it's always there? But one day the tadpole grew into a frog himself. And he left the lake for the first time. Ah, now I understand what all these frogs with brown robes and bald heads were talking about. Only now do I understand what water is. In the same way that one day that you will leave the pond of the five senses and the body and go into the realm of mind called jhanas. Only then will you know what will is when you've left it behind. The will, like water, has always been there, so you don't know what it is. Once it disappears, ah, now you know what it is. That's what happens in stillness. So the next step after seeing the body disappear, see will, choice, the doer disappear. And the next step after that is seeing the knower disappear. See the mind stop and cease. If you can do that, then you're either an anagami or fully enlightened. Anagami is one stage left. You've seen the emptiness of all things. What you thought was solid is now seen as full of holes. Emptiness. So full of holes, you'll understand why the Buddha called this the holy life. Next question. While I was meditating recently, mind was very quiet and peaceful, but suddenly there appears a hole there, a void. There, you understand why now. You're understanding the holy life. But also, if it's whole, it's the void, what is it void of and what's left? See what's disappeared and see what remains. And keep on meditating until everything has disappeared, until nothing at all remains. Until not even nothing. Once a person attains Sotapanna, can he control the bus or the bus driver? No, he's completely out of control. He was always out of control. Now he realizes how out of control he was. No self in there, so the Sotapanna just gives up 7 lifetimes before the bus reaches the terminus. Questions. Is having ego a bad thing? It's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a silly thing. So, like, you know, is, like, you know, watching soccer a good thing or a bad thing? Is this a silly waste of time, that's all? What do you do it for? It's like playing video games, a bad thing or a good thing? You ask your kids, that's a good thing, it's a good thing. You say, what are you wasting your time on? It's just kids being kids. Watching soccer is just men being men. Just watching the soapies. You have soapies? In. Watching the soapies is a girl thing. It's just girls being girls. And watching the mind is just a monk thing. It's monks being monks. So it's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just, you know, a thing. If no ego, will one behave like a kid? If you no ego, you behave like a Buddha. And how do we deal with the upset in us when our own pride is being hurt? Say, thank you, thank you, thank you for weakening my pride. You've hurt my pride, so you've weakened it. You've exposed my attachments. Oh, I'm so grateful to you. Thank you so much. Isn't that a wonderful thing to do? Because they're testing you out. It's like a teacher at school. And you've got an error there. And you suffer for it. Oh, thank you, I've found out a weakness there. Look, all this ego and pride. Now, why do people get into this? It's actually the joke I told the other day about pride. About these 4 Catholics. And they were in this coffee shop in Western Australia. And they were talking about their sons. Because one of their sons had just been ordained as a Catholic priest. And she was so proud of her son. She said, my son is now a Catholic priest. When he comes into a room, everybody lowers their head and they say respectfully, Father, Father. And she was so proud but the next woman having a coffee, that's nothing. That's ordinary. My son ordained as a priest a long time ago. Now he's a bishop. When he comes into a room, people kneel on their knees on the floor and they kiss his ring and they call him Your Grace, Your Grace. That's much better than just being an ordinary priest. And the third woman lifts up her nose, nothing. My son, he's a cardinal. When he comes into a room, everyone falls on the floor and grovels and calls My Eminence or Your Eminence. And they look to the fourth woman who is still finishing her latte. What about your son? And when she finished her latte, she said, My son's not a priest. He's not in holy orders. My son is 6'3", blonde haired, blue eyes, absolutely gorgeous. He's a self-made millionaire and he plays soccer for Manchester United. When he comes into a room, all the women faint before saying, My God, My God. Okay. So much for respect in religion. So all these egos with pride, thinking you're much better because your son is a footballer or something. Anyway, if marriage is considered as a social or cultural norm, what is the Buddhist perspective of living together or being a second wife or mistress? This person, when I was on Talkback Radio, I forget whether this was in Singapore or Perth, could you get on Talkback Radio? It's good fun because people shoot questions to you over the air and lots of people are listening to you, so you have to be very sharp and on the ball. There was a taxi driver rang up and his question was, he said, I'm married, I have a mistress, I'm having an affair, my wife doesn't know about it, is it bad? And my answer was, sir, if it was good, you would not be ringing me up to ask. Whoever asks this question, if the point is here that living together, or being a second wife or mistress, if it's living together, many people do that these days. And sometimes I see it's a commitment together. For some reason, they don't like the marriage. It may be legal reasons or their parents, or they think that maybe they can still have that commitment but don't need a piece of paper. Sometimes it's a thing which people do these days. And I've seen many, many good relationships that way. So that's a different thing. Even if you don't get married, but you have like a commitment inside, fine. But sometimes I ask, well, why don't you get married anyway? You don't have to go in the church and have all these big things. I can marry you. You know, I'll just give you a religious ceremony. You know, we can actually do some chanting for you and tell you some nice stories. Because I tell people that sometimes a marriage, it really is a commitment. And if you're living together, sometimes it's only an involvement. And I tell the difference with a simile in my book. The difference between a marriage, a commitment, and just going out together, an involvement, is the same as the difference between bacon and eggs. In bacon and eggs, if you think about it, the chicken is only involved, but the pig is committed. The pig has to give its whole life for bacon. Chicken only gives an egg. Got many left over. So if you have a marriage, you have to commit yourself, all of yourself. You don't keep anything back. In an involvement, you keep something back. So if you're married, it's no all in. You give everything. Sometimes people actually do live together without the formal marriage and they still give everything. If that's what you do, fine. But if you're just living together but you're not fully committed, you're holding something back, it will not last. If you're going to have that relationship, you have to give it 100%. But having a mistress, That's not even giving it 100%. It's 50% for her and 50% for my wife, maybe even different proportions. Having a second wife or mistress. Why is that question, having a second wife or mistress? Why didn't anyone ask, what about having a second boyfriend or a second husband? Because that doesn't happen, does it? Women are much more intelligent than that. Be careful, you men. Adultery is bad karma. You create a lot of suffering. But what happens is, you know, you're married with someone and you see another guy, or so another girl in the office or something. Because you're working and people have to dress up when they go to work and it's attractive, sometimes you lose it. A fantasy, a liking turns to a lust. When lust comes up, always remember this, lust drives you crazy. You're not in your right mind. And because you have lust for that person, you just can't think straight. All your priorities get scrambled. Which is why that when men have lust for another woman, when they're still married, they always think they will never get caught. It's okay. I'm just enjoying myself. Why not? You can't trust a mind when it has lust. Be careful there, because so many men, as soon as they have lust for a girl who's not their wife, all their ethics get scrambled. They may have been coming to Buddhist Gem Fellowship for years, but they can't see it. They can't see the pain they're causing. And when you do get found out, which eventually you do, and it wrecks your marriage, and it wrecks your kids, and it destroys your family, you say, what have I done? How could I not have seen this? Lust drives you crazy. It's like a madness of the mind. So please be careful. Before it gets that bad, walk away. Take evasive action. Otherwise, you'll be in big trouble. So, second wife or mistress is not a good idea. One woman is enough suffering. Two. I do apologize. Saying one husband is enough suffering. That's why women are much smarter. One's enough. Dear Ajahn, the unconditional love you said earlier, feeling happy when your wife having a good time with your best friend. Is this contradict to the fifth precepts? Are we encouraging the violation? This was just a simile, not to be taken seriously. What is your advice to overcome betrayal? Forgiveness. You have to build trust. Someone betrays your trust, give your trust again. Doesn't matter how many times people betray me, I will always trust them. Until such times that people feel, just why should I betray that person again? That's what I would do. But if you can't stand it and you know, you're not as spiritually advanced, then you just have to walk away. But try your very best. You can't forgive too much. By forgiving, you're always making really, really good karma. Eventually, you'll get the payoff. Those people who betray are making bad karma. They'll get their payoff eventually. Is there any remedy for a person who has violated one of the five precepts, or the person just has to live with the guilt consciousness? Just forgive, for goodness sake. It doesn't really matter. You've broken the five precepts. There's some bad karma there, but just forgive and learn. What's it like when you break the five precepts? Be honest. If you have had a mistress, quite honest, yeah, it was fun, but don't you feel so guilty that there's another person you're hurting? And what are you teaching your kids by your example? All the times you have to just lie to say why you're late from work or why you have to go somewhere. And all the deceit. And the person you married, you're not honest with. You can't have that trust anymore. What are you doing to your life? You're screwing it up. So if you really reflect on what's happening, you'd never do that. Remember, this monk said, if people would only be wise and know what adultery does, they would never do that, no more than they put their hand in the fire. So that's my answer there. How do you reply to a child when he said, the next life I want to be an animal, no need to worry about homework, etc.? This was said when he's depressed and had to work too much homework. Okay, you should take him to the dog pound. Put him in there for a few days. If you don't want to do that, give him his dinner in a bowl and put a lead on him and take him for a walk in the morning. I'll go through these questions quickly because I'm running out of time. What is Buddhism's point of view for test tube babies, right or wrong, and why? I can't see any reason why not. If a person can't have a baby in the ordinary way, you know, it's just you can have in vitro fertilization, nothing wrong with that at all. And sometimes some couples, they try so hard to have a child, they can't do it in one way, they do it in another way. That's fine. No trouble there at all. Since I have a lot of defilements, I have to be born again to suffer. This gives me fear, makes me feel unhappy. I'm getting old and I have not much time to get enlightened, but Nibbana is out of the way for me. Please advise. Okay, slow down. So like time is just an illusion. So it doesn't matter how much time it takes. The only time there is now. So make now a peaceful moment. Look at this moment you have now as something most valuable. The most precious thing you have is your life. And that life is what's happening now. So this moment is the most precious thing. If you could only make this moment pure, good, kind, then you're walking on the path to enlightenment. And you can do no more than that. There was my first teacher who was a Thai man, once said that his father gave him some seeds, some flower seeds, to plant in his garden when he was 6 years of age. He put these seeds in the garden and watered them every day. After 6 or 7 days, being a six-year-old, he became impatient. He could see nothing happening. And so he told his father, "It's a waste of time, my flowers aren't growing." And his father took his son aside and said, "When you plant seeds and water them, they have to germinate first. A small green shoot comes from the seed and pushes its way up. It takes time before it actually pushes its way up into the through the earth and to the surface. Be patient. Soon you'll see a little green shoot coming up." And that was enough encouragement from his father that he kept watering for another week. And as his father had predicted, after 2 weeks he saw this tiny green shoot start to poke up above the surface of the earth. He was so excited, his flowers were finally growing. So he started to water them twice a day. It didn't matter, they still kept growing and growing. When they were about 3 inches high after the third week, that's when he really lost his patience. He decided to stretch them to make them grow faster.